UDL is not the goal. Goal is that all kids are learning at high levels. It's not universally designed unless every single person can be included and every single person can work towards the same goal. One teacher with high expectations changed my whole entire life. And so a lot of the times when I'm talking to teachers, I'm like, just please be Mrs. Krause. And the thing is she had no evidence that I would be successful.
Hello, friends. Welcome back to Think Inclusive. Real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about how universal design for learning isn't just a checklist. It's a mindset for equity when you plan for all learners. Our guest is Katie Novak, internationally recognized UDL expert, author, and educator. What if inclusion wasn't just about moving a desk? What if equity meant designing classrooms where every learner belongs and thrives? Katie Novak is here to tell us why universal design for learning isn't the goal, but the tool that makes it possible. How inclusive practices dismantle systemic inequities, and why high expectations can change a student's life, including Katie's. Before we meet our guest, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and track progress in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge. And each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Katie Novak. Catch you on the other side. Katie Novak, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast. Again, for the third time, I believe. This is thrice guest. Wow, it's been a minute since we've talked. So before we jump into like content wise, like what's going on with you? Like what's happening?
I mean, things are great. Things are great. I'm consulting. I'm had this really amazing opportunities the past couple of years to do a lot of international work, which is just so amazing to see that our belief that all kids deserve this amazing education with opportunities for deeper learning. Like it is literally universal. So I've got to visit some really cool places and I'm teaching some classes at University of Pennsylvania, which has been lovely. I think everything that I do is teaching, but this is like true teaching where, you know, planning lessons and assessing work and providing feedback. And I love that part of the work as well. So things have been good. I'm a mom of four. I have three teenagers now, which is very scary, but goodness gracious, they're fun.
That's amazing. Thank you for the updates. You are probably most well known to our audience and as a universal design for learning expert. And so let's talk about UDL. And one of the things I always think about with UDL is that when people think and are trying to implement UDL, they think of it as a checklist. Like these are the things that I have to do. I got to hit all these boxes. But what you've said is that it's actually a mindset. So how can school leaders support this shift to UDL? Because a lot of schools are trying to move towards this framework without making it feel like it's just another thing to do.
Yeah. So what I would say, which is going to sound shocking, but I'm going to back it up, is like UDL is not the goal. The goal is that all kids are learning at high levels. And it really is founded in this belief that like all kids can learn at high levels when we get the conditions right. And the truth is that right now our schools, our classrooms, our districts are not designed in a way that allow all kids to learn at high levels. Like the nation's report card just came out. We're seeing that despite the fact that teachers are working harder than ever, we are not making progress. We don't have most kids in this country who are learning at high levels. And it's not that we're not putting all of this passion and investment. It's that we don't have the right conditions. And so universal design is not something necessarily that you can say that you do. It's something that's measured in the intention on the learners that we serve. So you can't say that you have universally designed something if you are not willing to include all students in that learning space, and if all of them don't have these access points and entry points to be able to make really significant progress. And I think that too often people will say we're doing this already, but then they don't have all students who are making a year of growth or more every single year. There are so many kids who are still in substantially separate settings. And when we're talking about universal design, we just have to say our job is to design an environment that works for everyone. There's very clear evidence that it doesn't work for everyone yet. And so let's move away from this one-size-fits-all instruction and the belief that we're doing it already because maybe we provide some options and choices, and say there are real barriers that are preventing kids from learning. And we have to put our heads together and solve these problems and figure out how to do it differently. And it really comes down to a lot of the times recognizing what the barrier is and then being flexible about eliminating it. So I love analogies. And the one I use recently is camping. You know, it's summer. It's like, woo, let's go camping. And, you know, I'll say to people, like, how many of you love camping? And you always have like a group that's like, yeah, camping. And then how many of you would say you do not like camping? And then there's an equal number generally. And it's like, okay, but if this conference was a camping trip and all of us needed to camp right now, do you feel like it would be possible for us to all enjoy time together around a campfire? If you got to decide, like, what are you going to eat and what are you going to drink and what is the activity that you want to take part in? Like, do you see a scenario where you could make that work? And everybody does, right? And then I'm like, okay, but too bad, I'm in charge actually. And I've decided that we're all going to have hot dogs and we're going to drink beer and then we're going to go swimming, but it's going to be in the lakes that you can't see the bottom and things tangle on your legs, you know, because that's magical. And then I'm like, and the thing is some of you are excited, right? And I don't want to like put shame on the hot dog and the beer. It's just like, it's very clear that that's not going to work for everyone. And there's two reasons. The first is just basic access. Some people have a plant-based diet. Some people have a sober lifestyle, or they're not old enough to drink. And some people don't know how to swim. And it's like, so does that mean now you're out of the camping trip? Because that's what we do to kids, right? Oh, you can't decode. Oh, you can't, you know, write in that way. Oh, you can't do it that quickly. Then you have to go somewhere else. And it's not about the choice, right? And so I say it does work for some of you. Some of you can't access it. But the more complex thing is that there's always a very, very sizable group who says, I do eat meat, I do drink alcohol, and I know how to swim, but I don't want to do that. And more and more kids have realized that is a viable option. They're just like, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to do it. Like, they could do it, but they choose not to do it. And so it's not just about choice, because like, imagine that I pull aside everybody who doesn't drink beer or won't drink beer. And I'm like, don't worry, I got you. Do you want your beer in a glass or in a cup or, you know, in a bottle? And you're like, what are you talking about, Katie? I don't drink beer. And a lot of what we say is universal design are choices like that. Where it's like, I gave them a choice. Like, do you want the beer in a cup? Do you want it in a frosty glass? Do you want? And it's like, but the kid doesn't consume alcohol. And so we have to think differently about, well, what really is the goal? The goal is that everyone has a drink. And there's nothing wrong with me providing beer as an option, but also having water and coffee and then making it BYOB. And suddenly we can all be a part of it. And so it's not universally designed unless every single person can be included and every single person can work towards the same goal. And that is a huge shift in just what we're trying to do, because you can't be in a district where most of your kids are not working towards or at or above grade level and say we're universally designing already, because that kind of goes back to John Dewey's quote. I think I've shared this with you before. In 1910, he said, to say that you've taught something that no one has learned is like saying you sold something that no one bought. And it wasn't designed for everyone to learn if not everybody learned.
I think, you know, you mentioned about students who are not present, right? Who are segregated, separate. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a misconception that, well, UDL is for everyone else, the framework. and then those kids over there, well, they get something extra special, right? Mm-hmm. And I love the analogy. In fact, I teach a class for pre-service teachers who are like alternate pathways.
Yep.
For certification. And I play your clip about the cake, the layers. And I'm like, nobody wants just one layer of cake.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the whole cake.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, okay, well, those kids over there, they just get like the frosting. Mm-hmm. You know, the extra special frosting. That's what they get. It's like, no, everyone gets everything. And so it just reinforces what you're saying, this idea of everyone gets everything, you know, and I love your analogy, especially about the cups, right? It's like, well, we can change what you can serve the beer in, but it doesn't change the fact that like some people don't want that or, you know, can't have it or whatever.
Yep.
That's a great analogy. I love that.
I mean, use it. It's yours. Listeners, it's yours. You know, go out on your next camping trip. And the thing is we would never, never, like, have a camping trip in that way. Like, if you showed up at my house, you just knock on my door and you come in, I'd be like, oh, hey, can I get you something to drink? And my natural inclination is going to be to list everything I have.
Right.
Like, oh, can I get you something to drink? I have water. I have coffee. I'd be able to get you a seltzer or a beer. Right. That's what we do naturally because we want to design these options so that they work. And it happens almost everywhere in the entire universe except for classrooms. And people will push back on me and go, oh, come on, Katie. Like, I know what you're saying, but sometimes you have to pay your taxes. And I'm like, greatest example of flexibility literally of all time. Like, the firm goal is that if you are making money, you do have to report those wages and you do have to file your taxes, but you can do it in hard copy and get like your forms from the post office. They're in multiple languages. You can do it online. You can do it through a TurboTax. You can hire an accountant to do it. But even if you don't do it in time, you can actually file an extension, right? Like, I could get to it. You can choose to pay over time, right? If you don't have all the money up front, you can get it in a direct deposit or in a check, right? There are so many options and choices, recognizing that, like, we're such a beautifully diverse group of humans and all of us can work towards the same goal, but we need lots of different pathways in order to get there. And we need to have the same true in our classrooms.
Yeah. And in to further your analogy, you know, you make money and you report your wages and taxes and stuff like that. But you also buy things, right? So you buy things and then depending on what you buy, it's not, you know, you don't have to buy certain things necessarily, but that also provides taxes. So it's like, it is all about choice. It is all about options. Yep. And I'm just thinking about like, what if our classrooms were really more like real life? You know?
Oh my gosh. Yes. You're speaking my language.
Yes. Yes. It's like we have this artificial environment that, you know, the teacher is the all-knowing, all-powerful, omniscient one who, you know, doles out the information to these students when really it's much more organic when we're in real life and when you're in your job, you know. You may or may not know the things, but you work collaboratively to fulfill a goal, typically. You know what I mean?
I mean, the model made sense before books were widely available, before there were public libraries, before you had internet and multimedia. Whereas, like, truly, if you didn't get it from the teacher, there was no other place to get it, right? But we are so far from that where, like, we're still operating schools like that. We move every 18 minutes. Like, now we do history. Now we do science, when learning is so wildly interdisciplinary. You know, so much of it is still individual when learning is so collective and collaborative. And it's just we're using a really antiquated model that doesn't make sense and hasn't made sense in a very, very long time.
Yeah. Gosh, man, I have so many. I want to go off on so many different tangents here. I'm gonna go out on a limb here and ask you about how you are feeling about public ed in this current moment. We are recording in June of 2025.
Yep.
This will air in the fall sometime. But how are you feeling? What are you hearing from educators you're listening to? It seems like we're in a precarious situation in a time. But as you're thinking, as you're talking about like all the things that, you know, of how we need to reform education, could this be the silver lining that we really are focusing on education like never before? Could there be some positive change in all of this, you know, tumultuous situation?
I love public education. I think public education is radical. It is that we literally serve everyone. And I wish so deeply that we were able to deliver on the promise that public education provides to families, because we say all are welcome. We'll provide an education no matter what. We'll provide an excellent education no matter what. And the truth is that that hasn't necessarily been delivered, not for lack of trying, but the system simply is not nimble enough to meet the needs of kids. And so I think a lot of the kind of pushback that you get is that people saying, okay, so it's available to all of us, but like, is it really serving our children? Is it really allowing them to become the people that they want to be? And I think that we have evidence that there is very wide variability in that. But I believe in the institution of we will provide something excellent for everyone. I think the work is how can we say confidently that this is excellent, what we are providing? And so I think number one, we have to really look hard at our systems to say, what is the support that educators need to be able to do this better? We are super underfunded when it comes to professional development, especially in the past couple of years. As money gets tighter, it's trying to cut things that have the furthest distance from kids, which a lot of the times is your instructional coaches, your professional development, right? Your classroom support. And so what I do a lot of work now on is this concept of like a multi-tiered system of support, which is not just the MT, which is like we have tier one, two, and three, but what's the system all around that in terms of your leadership drivers? So how do we build shared responsibility for all kids so we can work together differently? How do we ensure that we're appropriately staffed and we have a schedule that allows for really innovative time on learning and staff collaboration? What is the requirement for family and community collaboration? Because if families don't feel as though the public school is offering what they need, public school needs to listen to those voices. That's what's so radical about it. Is it something we build together? We don't only have these leadership drivers, but we have like this competency drivers. Like, teachers are struggling. I predominantly work in professional development with educators that are like, I am literally doing everything I know how to do. And so we have to provide better opportunities to support our teachers, which is going to be your professional development, your instructional coaching, your learning walks and instructional rounds, the idea of building common planning and professional learning communities. And that we're seeing that like get squeezed. And yet we're expecting, with the world changing so quickly and kids becoming more diverse and technology evolving, we're not giving people time to think about how to do it differently. And it's really hard to change when you're running on the hamster wheel. And so when you're talking about multi-tiered systems, you have like your leadership drivers, you have your competency drivers, and then you have your implementation drivers, which is, are we giving educators really high quality instructional materials that are flexible, that are inclusive, that are engaging to kids? Are we allowing them to use these innovative, amazing technologies, which allows them to transform their classrooms? Are we providing them with really good sources of assessment, like really good data? So we know like who is making progress so we can like let them to continue to go. But we have to know really early, like, oh, shoot, what we have here isn't working for these kids. We have to do something different. Let's come together. Let's think about it. Let's do it differently. But what we're missing in so many cases, we're missing the high quality instructional materials. We're missing the really brilliant sources of data, or we don't have the data systems that are nimble enough that provide a visualization so we really know how kids are doing, right? We don't have the professional development. We don't necessarily have the leadership. And so I think that public education has to do a better job investing in the systems so that people who choose this radical work have the support they need to serve kids. Because again, if we get the conditions right in the system, then we get the conditions right for teachers and we get the conditions right for families. And this isn't to say that there's not value in alternative education and charter education and private education, right? Because I think that having all of those options is a part of what makes education so incredibly vast and differentiated. But I think that to know that this baseline of tier one is that regardless of where you move in this country, you are guaranteed access to a free, excellent public education. And if you choose another path, you get to choose another path. That's the beauty of freedom. But we have to make sure that public education is a good option, or it's not really a choice for parents, is it?
Stay with us because coming up after the break, Katie takes us deeper into the heart of equity. We'll talk about why inclusion isn't just moving a desk, how systems need to change to truly serve all learners, and the four pillars Katie says every school must embrace: placement, participation, high expectations, and belonging. Plus, you'll hear a powerful story about a teacher who changed Katie's life and what that means for every educator listening today. This show is produced by the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. MCIE partners with educators and school systems to promote authentic inclusion, foster change, and support the implementation of inclusive practices. Whether it's district-wide transformation, customized learner planning, or professional learning and coaching, MCIE walks alongside educators every step of the way. And here's the best part. Our work begins with a conversation. So if you're ready to create schools where every learner belongs, visit mcie.org to get in touch and start that conversation today. Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it isn't a choice. So yeah, thank you for sharing that. In your podcast, The Education Table, there is one episode that you talk about inclusion versus inclusive practice. And so the word inclusion has a lot of baggage. And so I'm wondering if you could explain or differentiate for our audience what you mean when those two things are different.
And it's okay. I love this. So inclusion does have so much baggage. Like, first of all, we think of inclusion as being like, we put kids who have special education support needs in a mainstream classroom with their peers, right? But like, true inclusion is everybody is included. Everybody.
Yes.
So your students who might have support needs because of learning disabilities, your students who might struggle with, you know, challenges with social emotional regulation or behavior, students who are multilingual, students who have a need for acceleration and enrichment, right? Like, how do we ensure that everybody gets what they need, right? And that's really the idea. It has been essentially tagged to, we're going to take students and we're going to somehow like pick them up from this magical special education place and we're going to put them down. And as long as they're in the room, truly, if they're enrolled in the class, you can report them as included. And so this gets into the nuances of this funky language around least restrictive environment. For I know that the audience probably has a pretty good background knowledge in special education, but essentially we are required by law to ensure that students are in the least restrictive environment available. And then there's these numbers. So LRE1, least restrictive environment one, is that they're with their peers in general education for 80% of the day or more. So there's still some allowances for like special education programming, potentially intervention classes, speech and language, working with like PT. But if you're in 80% of classrooms with your peers, then you're considered to be fully included. LRE2 would be if the needs of the students is so significant that the classroom is too restrictive and a kid's not making progress, then they might be 40 to 79% of their day, which is LRE2. And LRE3, which consider is not included, is 39% of the day or less. And generally, you'll see kids who are in lunch, maybe in specials, and then they'll get their core education in a separate setting. So a lot of people think of it as like, okay, so the classroom is too restrictive. Let's move the kid. And what we need to think of it is, why is the classroom restrictive? Let's eliminate the barriers. And one of the things that I would always say is, I will make my class the least restrictive environment available. You tell me what the barriers are in here and we'll eliminate them, because I want every kid to be a part of this classroom, right? So inclusion is tricky because it really technically is the time of the day the kid is enrolled. But that's a really low bar, because that could mean that I am going to have a dinner party. And this is where I talk about inclusive practice. So like, inclusion is, you're invited. You can come to the party. And then you're just going to sit in the room and starve, because the only thing you can eat is like a leaf of lettuce and a glass of water, right? So included is like, we have invited you in and you now are in this space. But there's nothing magical about like moving a kid's desk into a classroom. The concept of inclusive practice is that we have really thought about what are the barriers and how can we design this space so that you're getting exactly what you need while you're working towards the same goals as everyone else. So I could invite everyone to the dinner party and be like, oh, vegetarians, FYI, there's a head of iceberg over there and a glass of water. And like, technically, you could be included. I could invite you to the party, but like, you're not truly participating with and alongside everybody else. And what is necessary for some in an inclusive class should be made available to everyone in terms of like true universal accommodations. And if you're embracing universal accommodations, you can create a class that is the least restrictive environment for all students. And I work with schools all the time who are, you know, really starting to move to more inclusive settings because they've been able to remove some of those restrictions because of more inclusive practice.
I'm going to tell you something I've overheard people say, and I'd like you to respond to this, because I think it goes against kind of this idea of what you're talking about. So what I've heard is, okay, well, for Johnny, who is in third grade and he's in an autism class, an autism only class, inclusion for him is that he's in with his peers that are just like him. He feels accepted. Mm-hmm. He has friends. And they're able to modify, you know, for the kids that are in that class. And that's inclusion for him. I mean, he likes it. He wants to be there. His parents want him to be there. So, you know, inclusion for him is there. Inclusion for, you know, Sally is, she's in gen ed 100% of the time, no pullout, and that works for her. So I'm wondering, have you ever heard that argument before?
I have heard that argument, and I honestly think that argument goes back to the fact that the system is not truly inclusive. Mm-hmm. Because like, I do not blame a parent. Let's say that Johnny was included in first grade and it was awful.
Right.
It was a terrible year for the kid. It was a terrible year for the family. The teacher was frustrated and overwhelmed. There was no connections. As a parent who believes deeply in inclusion with a child with support needs who is fully included, I would never, ever try to convince a parent to remove their kid from that type of setting. Okay. Because being included wasn't inclusive, right? And so I think that we have to say, you know what? You're right. That did not meet the needs of Johnny. And what he's experiencing now is maybe better than that, but we can do better. Because ultimately, we want to create a space that all students really see themselves as general education students, because they all are general education students. And the benefit is not just for Johnny. The benefit is for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times people talk about inclusion. My daughter's name is Aylin. She is a rock star. She's the coolest human ever. But like, I'll talk in examples that it's like, oh, well, it would be so good for Aylin to be included. I was like, Aylin's awesome. And everybody else loses out if she is not included, because she thinks differently and she is like, you know, good and kind to her soul and she will never be a bystander. Some people call that dysregulation, but if she sees something, she's going to call it out, right? But I just think that this concept of we know that diverse groups are more successful in work, in corporate spaces, right, than groups that have like groupthink, right? And if we know that we're more productive when we're with people who are different than us, then we should try to create spaces where that happens. But again, I know that some families have put faith in a system that failed them. And so they're so scared. And so in some cases, I love the work of diffusion of innovation in general, which is that like there are some people who are just more risk averse than others. And so if we say, hey, we're going to do inclusion, right, we're going to make sure that all of the teachers who opt into this first year have really amazing training, they have high quality instructional materials, we're going to co-serve those classes with co-teachers who have GASP, common planning time, we're going to have instructional coaches in there. And if you have teachers who opt in as early adopters and you give them what they need to be successful, there will be a demonstration of impact. Evidence is very, very clear that when it is done really, really well, it's a better space for kids. They're going to be more successful. And there was recently this report that came out. It was like in the Hessinger report that had some like clickbait title. I want to actually find it because it was something like insane, like inclusion is bad.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes. Scholar says evidence for special education is flawed, right? And I actually wrote a letter to the editor and they didn't respond. But I want to read to you one line in this study.
Please
because
do.
Basically it's saying that there is nothing special about shoving a kid in a general education room, which we all know. We all know. So it's actually an argument for what we're talking about. And so you know, he basically talks about like, we know that special education services need to be provided in addition to an excellent, inclusive general education. And if we can't provide both of those things, there are some cases where students will have better outcomes if they are self-contained or if they're segregated, because it's because of the flaws of general education, not the flaws of the special education services. And so it says here, school leaders are in a tough spot when they have to decide whether to invest in improving the general education classroom or to refine interventions that can happen outside the classroom, right? And like, it's just that like people are torn where it's like, well, that classroom isn't really the least restrictive environment yet. And if we just put a kid in, there's a potential that they're not going to do well. And that's true, right? But there's also a risk to saying, well, we're not going to include them because it is the least restrictive environment. And so I actually read it and agreed with the fact that we need to talk about like what makes inclusive practice effective for kids who have support needs. And, you know, I think that the whole field should be interested in that. But there's nothing special about just inclusion and moving the seat. There's nothing special about special education. It is the quality of those two things working together that's going to make a big difference for kids. And that goes back to my systems beef.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the whole thing. Inclusion versus inclusive practice.
Yeah.
Right. And the article you mentioned, the example is it's about priorities, really. You know, they're in a tough spot, but they have to make a choice. If they don't make a choice, neither of them, neither the specialized programs or general ed will get any better. You have to actually make a choice. Now, I think we would say invest in general ed, because the stronger that general ed is, that's better for everybody. But yeah.
I would say invest in both of them. You know, let's just get like an influx of moolah and let's just make it rain.
Yeah. Lots of money.
Katie for education secretary.
please. No. Let's talk about, we have been talking about inequities, right? Mm-hmm. That are the system that we have is inequitable for many, 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 many students. But you have said that UDL can help dismantle some of these inequities. Yes. So How can UDL be a tool? Now, UDL is not the goal, right? But how can UDL be a tool for equity?
Love it. So I wrote a book, Equity by Design, with my dear friend and colleague, Mirko Chardon. And in it, we define equity in the same way that the Washington State Administrative Association defines equity when they're evaluating their principals. And it talks about that equity in education is really four different things. The first is general access to general education classrooms with peers. So you're just thinking about straight up, does every kid have the same chance of ending up in a general education class? And we know the answer is no. Right? Students who have disabilities, students who are level one multilingual learners, right? They don't have the same access to a classroom with their peers, right? So the first is, do all students have access to the, you know, everything that the system offers? The next is, if they have access, do they have the same opportunities as all of their peers? So this is not about getting the kid in the classroom and then putting them in a back corner at a table with another educator and they're doing something different. It's truly about like shared learning. So participation with their peers when they're included. So the first is just placement. They're in the class. The next is participation with peers. The next is the same opportunities to have teachers who have the highest expectations for their success. So do all kids have access to not only really highly qualified educators, but highly qualified educators who truly, honestly believe that all kids are capable of very, very high levels of success. And that requires both a personal teaching efficacy, collective teaching efficacy, and high expectations. And we know if we look at visible learning from John Hattie, nothing touches teachers with high expectations for kids. There is not a single alterable variable. There's not one curriculum we could adopt. The word is variable, not varial. But like there's not curriculum, there's not pedagogy. It's like if you get highly, highly qualified teachers who are like, heck yeah, all kids can learn when we get the conditions right. I'm going to figure out those conditions because I'm good at this and I believe in kids, right? And then the last is, do all kids report the same levels of hope and belonging? And so like we have to look at our systems and say, okay, who's included already and who's not included yet? Once you're included, are they really given the same opportunities to learn at high levels, to make choices about what they're learning about and the process of learning and how they're going to share what they know when it's appropriate by grade level standard? And then how do we ensure that all kids really do have access to teachers who are not going to lower the bar, who will presume competence? Because the least dangerous assumption, I love this language. This is a researcher, Donnelly. The least dangerous assumption is that these kids are going to be successful. It is so dangerous to say they can't. And we hear this both from general education and special education, right? Oh, you can't put them in there. They can't do that. They can't read. They can't behave. And it's like, maybe they can't yet, or maybe they can't in that way, but let's stop labeling kids and putting ceilings over their head and instead say, how do I have to build a different skill set or how we have to change these conditions? Because the kid can, the kid will. We just haven't figured it out yet. And there's just so much deficit-based thinking in the system that prevents kids who maybe even are included and have the same opportunities as their peers. But we know from the New Teacher Project's opportunity myth is that the vast majority of work done in American classrooms is significantly below grade level. So students might be included together and they might have the same opportunities to learn. But if those opportunities to learn do not provide access to the highest levels of thinking, to grade level learning, to deeper opportunities to truly engage, then that's not going to prepare them for the world that they're going to live in. And then lastly, the reactions from kids about their education right now across the entire country, whether you're in private or public, is so heartbreaking. I was recently reading a study that they were doing these interviews with kids and they were just asking kids like, how's school? What do you do? What? And then they thematically coded the words that students used, and 75% of the words that kids used to describe education were negative. So we don't have kids who are hopeful that what they're learning is going to help them do what they want to do. We don't have kids who feel like school is really for them, that understands their interests, that help them belong. We don't always have people who believe that kids can learn at high levels. We don't have all of them accessing the best of what the system has available. And many of them are not even included because our national LRE rate is still only about 67%, which means you're looking at almost 4 out of 10 kids who have a documented disability who don't even have a placement with their peers yet.
Wow. Wow. So you mentioned, was it four things?
Yep.
Placement. I'm not going to remember them.
It's basically placement, shared participation, high expectations, and belonging and hope.
Wow. And so is that like a Novak education?
No, because we actually, like, it was in a Washington administrative, I think it was like a principal evaluation, and we loved it so much.
Because a lot of times we will talk about participation, and learning. Now I'm going to forget it.
Yeah. And then there's Shelley Moore.
Membership, participation, and learning. MPL. There you go.
Yeah. So Shelley Moore also has the 5 P's of inclusion.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which are very, very similar, but it's so beautiful.
Yeah. No, I really like the way that you mentioned that too, because again, it was nice to hear it in a different way because I'm just so used to hearing it with those particular words. But especially the high expectations. Because what I'm hearing you say is that is a huge factor in student learning is if the teacher actually believes in the students, right? And while curriculum and pedagogy change, you know, and ebb and flow, if you have a educator who believes in their students, that could be the thing, right? That really makes a difference in a particular learner's life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My life was changed by an excellent teacher. You know, a lot of people, because I care so much about education, you know, I have a master's degree, I have a doctoral degree. People assumed that I was like really great at school. I was absolutely not. I was like lowest level, tracked low, C's get degrees, right? My kids make the joke, C's get degrees and D's get you a doctorate, because they have happened upon some of my earlier transcripts and they're like 45 out of what for chemistry? I'm like 100. Yeah, that was great. It was 45 out of 100. And, you know, clearly I'm very capable. And like, I didn't show that I was capable in the right way early enough. And so I was with like the motleyest crew of kids ever. And I got all the way to my senior year and I met this teacher and like, we were like, I mean, this was a crew, let me tell you, you know, like my very, very best friends from high school that I still talk to today, like none of them went to college. Like it just wasn't like a group that people believed would do anything. And those beliefs sometimes become realities. And so the teacher, her name is Mrs. Krause. I've written about her in multiple books, was like, all right, here you go. You got 3 good options here, right? Work, military, college, right? We're all like, college, right? Like you can imagine it's like a bad 80s sitcom. And so she's like, I want you to know like your paths. And so like basically our curriculum is going to be preparing you for all of those paths because like maybe you don't go to college now, but I want you to know the process in 10 years. Or maybe you go to the military first, but then you realize you can go to college for free, right? So her plan was loosely, she found like alumni that went into every branch of the military. She was going to bring in military recruiters. We were going on field trips, right? But like, what is that experience? What are the benefits of that? What are maybe some of the things that we know were our challenges of that? Same thing. If you go into work, what does that mean? We all had to learn how to fill out a job application, create a resume. We had to do all of our speaking and listening with like interviews. She would bring in local businesses, like we'd critique each other. And then there was like the, you're going to fill out a college application. We're going to do college interviews. You're going to talk to your guidance counselors. We're talking about financial aid. And so very early on, one of the things we had to do was just write a college essay. And I've always loved to write. Like I have notebooks of bad love poetry. And so I wrote an essay and like she took me aside. I don't remember when it was, but it had to be pretty early in the year. And she was like, your writing is so brilliant. Like not technically, because like I probably didn't have a lot of complete sentences. I'm a poet. And so she was like, oh my gosh, this is so great. And I went back and I looked at your transcript and like, you've never been challenged. And like, it's shocking to me that nobody has seen this like brilliance in you. And you are going to go into honors. Now, this is like a double bump because you have like AP, you have honors, you have like CP1, you have CP2, which is like me and the dregs of society. And we did have an amazing teacher, right? I loved her for that. And so she's like, you're going into honors. And I'm like, I don't want to hang out with those losers. Like, I don't want to be in honors. And she already called Tom and Kath. So like it was cooked. I don't know if you've ever seen Wizard of Oz, where you go from like the black and white to like Technicolor. Yeah. Like anyone, like come at me. Anyone who wants to tell me that a low level class is as good as an honors class, I can say from experience that's incorrect. Yeah. It was a better education. It wasn't like preparing for job. It was like, how do we want to like think about this drama unit? Someone's like, we should do one act plays and then we should write a grant and go to the elementary school and put them on. She's like, oh, great idea. And then like people would say things like, oh, like, can we go outside today? And she's like, I love that idea. I'm like, you can't let us outside. People are going to smoke. And then like, they don't smoke. Right? And it was, I can't even, it reminds me of like Jean Anion's Hidden Curriculum is okay. This concept of like, it's not like, yes, like she was amazing. The classes were different. One was like, if you ever go to college, there was no like, get ready for the military, get ready for work. Right. And this is the best teacher I've ever had in my whole life. The class was you're going to college. You're going to be successful. And we trust that you will. And we trust you outside by yourself. And we trust you to go down and hang out with elementary school kids. And it changed my life. And I was so pissed. I was like, this is what they've been doing for like 8 years. Like we're in rows, we're doing worksheets, right? And again, like the military and work, like those are brilliant pathways, but they should be available to every kid at every level, right? Like we're saying a lot about work and military if we're like, we'll prepare this group and not this group. I believe EP students should know the military is an amazing pathway. Work could be an amazing pathway, right? Job readiness. Like we're seeing so many more jobs that require more traditional, you know, like the vocational training, like let everybody know about them. But the system has such a stick up its, you know what, about like, this is what some kids deserve. And the rest can choose from this.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to these are all incredible options, but let's stop separating kids and deciding kind of what they get. So anyway, I was like, this is ridiculous. So I applied to get into University of New Hampshire and I did not get in. I got waitlisted, but then I eventually got in. And I went in like guns blazing. I'm like, I'm freaking smart, everyone, right? And, you know, maybe I had to work a little harder because I didn't have the same, you know, I had some lagging skills.
Sure.
But I was like, I'm going to be a teacher like Mrs. Krause, and like, I'm going to end this. So anyway, this is the highlight of the story, which you're going to love. Hopefully, listeners, you love. I go on. I become a teacher. I love it. I can never do anything else with my life. Like, I'm so into education. And I write UDL Now. I write another version. I write another version. In the acknowledgments, it's to Mrs. Krause. And I'm like, I don't know where I would be or who I would be without you. Like you picked me out of a class and it changed my life. Like it truly changed my life. And so I tracked her down. She's long since retired. I'm like, oh my gosh, we have to go out to dinner. I have a gift for you. Like I go out with my sister. I'm like literally like fangirling, like, oh my gosh, Mrs. Krause. So I like wrap the book and she's like, oh my gosh, like I followed your career. You're so great. I was like, I just want to thank you because you changed my life. And she's like, what did I do? Has no memory of it. And I'm like, I wrote this essay, this college essay. And she's like, oh, I remember the essay. So I'm like, I really am the greatest poet of our generation. She remembered the essay like 20 years later. And I'm like, Navi, right. So she loves the essay. And then I was like, and then you put me in honors. And she has no memory of it. Zero.
Wow.
And she's like, what? And I was like, Mrs. Krause. And then I started worrying, like, is that like a made up memory? Like I wanted to do like a public records request of myself. Like, what if I made it up? What if I never took an honors class? Like it was, you know, because like it's been a while.
Sure.
And so then he starts asking these questions like, oh, what year did you graduate? Like, who is the principal? And I was like, and so then she's like, oh my gosh. Oh yeah. I hate it. You know, whenever that principal, she's like, yeah, I used to do that all the time. And I was like, I'm sorry, what did you do all the time? And she's like, oh, I hated that tracking system. I hated that leveling system. And every year I would go for it and be like, come on, like, let me bust it up. Let me have like a truly inclusive class. And they would say no. And so like every year I would like choose a couple of kids subtext who no one thought would be successful.
Oh my gosh.
Because it was like, if Katie Thibodeau can step up and do this, right? And I was like, I'm going to go vomit in the bathroom now. And she was like laughing hysterically. And like, I was laughing hysterically. And she's like, no, no. And I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, I give it to you. She's like, no. Like, I remember your writing. Your writing was brilliant. She's like, but it like pained me that I couldn't do it with everybody. And eventually I did. Eventually I did. So like, we're talking about this demonstration of impact, this diffusion of innovation. Like, if you pull enough kids and go, look, you give them this education and they rise, right? And it's like one teacher with high expectations changed my whole entire life. And so a lot of the times when I'm talking to teachers, I'm like, just please be Mrs. Krause. And the thing is she had no evidence that I would be successful. But it was less dangerous to put me in that honors class than to keep me where I was.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That was great.
Isn't that crazy, though? It was like an accident.
Oh, that. Oh, my gosh. Yes. Yes. You too can be Mrs. Krause.
Yeah.
Yes. Just believe in your students. Take, you know, least dangerous assumption. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was amazing.
I mean, it's like literally it feels like the story of my life. Like I still like think about her all of the time and just like, wow. You know, where would I be? Like, I don't think I would have gone into education. Like, I mean, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. You were the starfish that she threw back into the ocean.
Chicken soup for the soul. I love that. That was basically the quality of my writing back in the day. Mushy gushy.
Oh my goodness. Awesome. Well, we are almost out of time. So
you're going to have to invite me back for number four.
I want to do. I'd have you on every week if I could. Okay. So two things. Number one, please tell our audience where they can find all of your stuff, your books, website, social media, the education table, all that. And then I'll save the last one for the last.
So I'm very easy to find. My website is Novak Education, N-O-V-A-K Education. And you'll see links there to all of the blogs and the podcast and all of the books are linked there. I also have an amazing, amazing team that I work with. If you click on like About Us and Meet the Team, we have people who specialize, you know, in early education, in higher education, in, you know, working with districts to really disrupt and change systematically what's happening with special education in alignment with like FAPE and, you know, LRE, which is like, you know, all of the laws surrounding special education. And so if you are feeling like, goodness gracious, like we would love help with this work. I have an amazing team of like-minded, spunky, brilliant educators, and we love working with schools and districts.
Before we get into the mystery question, let's take a quick look back at what we've covered today. We explored why high expectations can change a student's life, and Katie shared her own story of a teacher who believed in her and how that moment shaped her entire career. Now, it's time for one of my favorite parts of the show, the mystery question, and this one comes straight from my daughter. It's a fun one. If you could disappear for 24 hours, what would you do? Stick around. Katie's answer might surprise you. Awesome. Thank you so much. Okay, so the last part of the episode is the mystery question. And I don't think you had the mystery question the last time you were.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Okay, so the mystery question is written by my 12-year-old.
Oh, yes.
So my 12-year-old is probably our biggest fan because she listens regularly.
Okay. Hey, girl.
And she would always be like, you know, asking about the mystery question. She's like, hey, can I write some mystery questions for you? I'm like, yes, yeah. Please. Mm-hmm. So she's written a bunch and I've only got a couple left. I got to have her write some more. So I'm going to select the mystery question. I'm going to read it and then we'll both answer it. Okay.
Okay,
so here we go. All right. So if you were invisible for one day, mm-hmm. what would you do? And in parentheses, it says fully, you cannot appear.
Okay. No, I do. If I like the subtext.
Yes. Okay. Like, so you absolutely cannot appear. And I would say it says one day. So let's say 24 hours. So
okay.
If you were invisible for one day, what would you do? What would I do?
I mean, can I pick the day?
Absolutely. There's no rules.
Like a part of me wants to say like I'll be around people to see what they say about me, but I'd prefer not to know that.
I know, like, right? Yeah.
Like, only if you're going to say good things. Like I don't want to be like, ugh. So I love like a deep conspiracy theory.
Okay.
And so like on the day that maybe like the CIA, FBI, right? Like you're having a big meeting and it's something big, like Roswell or like JFK or like, are we living in the Truman Show right now? Right. Like, but like, I need to see like the agenda and like the most top secret meeting, like, because it can't possibly like negatively impact like my self-image. And it's like, and I can keep a really good secret. I'm like a vault. But like, I would love to know like what the actual truth is in one of those big historical, like Bermuda Triangle, like Roswell, New Mexico. Like, what is the story? And we've been promised. We've been promised some leaking.
We're promised.
We get nothing. We get nothing. So I'm going in to get that information.
Okay. I like it. I like it. Yeah, I was thinking something like government, you know, like maybe if I could spend like 24 hours in the Oval Office, you know, just like being a fly on the wall. But I'm reconsidering that because I would love to. I'm like a public radio and like NPR, PBS, like geek. Like I love all things, you know, public radio and news and stuff like that. And I would love to like just be somewhere where they're crafting the, you know, the scripts having the interviews and just like wandering around without being noticed and just kind of observing people in their like natural habitat. I think that would be a lot of fun. So, and I could do that any day at that.
Yeah. I mean, you might not even need to be invisible. You could probably just ask to show up.
I know. So I was like, who is this guy? Yeah. I know. I'm wearing my WABE public radio, NPR hat for Atlanta.
So I have worked with PBS Learning Media here in Massachusetts and they are wonderful.
Oh, no doubt.
Wonderful.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. That's amazing. Oh, well, thank you so much for indulging me with the mystery question and my daughter.
No, I love that. That's my favorite part. It's so good.
All right. Katie Novak, once again, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. I can't wait for number 4.
That was Katie Novak. Here is what I'm taking with me. UDL isn't the goal. It's the tool that helps us create equity when we design for all learners. And high expectations, they are not optional. They are transformative. Here's one practical step for educators. Start by asking, what barriers exist in my classroom? And how can I remove them so every student can work toward the same goal? Share this episode with a colleague who's building inclusive schools. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcast. Shout out to all the hardworking moms out there making the holiday season special for your families, and especially to my wife, Brianna, for always coming up clutch with making sure everyone is taken care of. Your hard work and dedication is appreciated. Do you have someone that you appreciate? I'd love to know who that person is. You can always email me at tvagus@mcie.org. Now, let's roll the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, master. I basically wear all the podcast hats and baseball caps. This show is a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling, and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Our original music is by Miles Kredich with Extra Vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsor, IXL. Visit IXL.com/inclusive for more. And fun fact for today, did you know December is one of the most inclusive months of the year? Around the world, people celebrate Christmas, winter solstice, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, Las Posadas, Bodhi Day, and even International Human Solidarity Day, all in the same month. It's a great reminder that classrooms can reflect this diversity by inviting students and families to share their traditions. When we do that, we turn the season into a celebration of belonging for everyone. Are you celebrating one of these traditions this December? Let me know about it. Email me at tvagus@mcie.org. I read every single message. If you made it this far, you're officially part of the Think Inclusive Inclusion crew. Want to help us keep moving forward with inclusive education? Head to mcie.org and click the donate button. Give $5, $10, $20. It helps us keep partnering with schools and districts to move inclusive practices forward and support educators doing the work. Find us on the socials, almost everywhere, at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.
Podcasterole. Welcome in.